This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Craig Callender is a professor and chair in the Department of Philosophy. Much of his work is on the intersection of time and science, especially in physics and psychology. Tonight, he'll discuss how the speed of scientific innovation often outpaces society's ability to understand and respond to attendant ethical issues, and how UC San Diego, as a public institution and major source of innovation, will provide leadership to shape society's response to new science and technology.
Hello, thanks for coming. Contrary to recent remarks by Mark Rubio the other night in the debate, I think philosophy is an awesome profession to be in. I am a philosopher, and so I would know. And what I do is I work on hard conceptual problems and more than one science. Meanwhile, I'm teaching courses that range from foundations of quantum mechanics all the way to environmental ethics. My own research is interdisciplinary in that way, too. I work on the physics and philosophy of time. Unlike the other speakers, however, I'm not here to talk about my research, which is awesome, and you should go to my website. What I'm here instead to talk about is to present a kind of vision of for the future of the university. The chancellor challenged us in a strategic plan initiative to address social disparities. I think that one really good way to do this, which capitalizes on UCSD's great strengths, is to help close what I call the science ethics gap. Ethics, most generally put, is just about a subject about what you ought to do. And what you ought to do depends on what you can do and what you know. And those things keep changing. As an adult, I know a lot more than I did as a child, and therefore I'm responsible for a lot more. But this is also true for societies. And two facts make this especially problematic. The first is that our existing ethical norms, legal structures, and policies are all adapted to past technology. We're not too good about thinking ahead. The second thing is that the pace of technological innovation has expanded, exponentially in the last 100 years or so. It's amazing when you think about it. Homo sapiens have been around for about 200,000 years, and in just the blink of an eye, everything has changed technologically. I always think about how it must have been for my grandmother. So she grew up in a world of candles and horses in the rural Azores, and survived to a point where she was, in a world of the internet, Wi-Fi, neural implants, and whatnot. Think of those changes over just that one lifetime. It's amazing. Now, these changes bring great promise, but they also leave in their wake a trail of ethical dilemmas. What I want to do is talk about, to give you an idea of what I have in mind, I'll mention two quick examples. Neither of these are science fiction cases. Neither of these could have been conceived even 10 or 15 years ago. Both rely on new technology, and both demand urgent action right now. So this is Scott Routley in 2012. He was a physics major and had a promising robotics career ahead of him when tragedy struck. He was driving away from his grandparents' house with his girlfriend when a police cruiser hit him. The girlfriend and the policeman were both left unharmed, but a head injury quickly proved devastating to Scott. He showed no signs of consciousness for over 12 years and was classified as being in a vegetative state. Now, enter functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRIs. fMRIs can be used as fancy brain scans. The neurologist Adrian Owen devised a simple test to see whether you could sort of speak through an fMRI. And the idea is this: in healthy subjects, you took people and gave them the instructions, if you want to say yes, if you want to communicate yes, think that you're playing tennis. If you want to communicate no, imagine that you're navigating through your kitchen. In healthy subjects who could reveal what they were thinking, it's 100% reliable diagnostic. Now put in people in vegetative states. In the first run of experiments, 17% answered questions accurately and were able to communicate. Scott was one of them. He was the first person in human history to communicate what it's like, from the inside of what presented to be a vegetative state. Somebody like him shouldn't exist, but he does. They asked him questions like about his care. Do you want to watch more hockey? He's Canadian, so the answer was yes. They asked him questions you might be curious about. Are you in pain? And thankfully, he answered no. I like this example because it illustrates perfectly the kind of thought, case I have. You have this new technology, and with fMRI technology, you can give voice to the most vulnerable people on Earth. And yet, as soon as you do, you have a suite of ethical dilemmas. Probably the most acute of which is, of course, whether you should ask patients like Scott whether they wish to continue to live. Let me go to my next case, which is, who should driverless cars kill? 1.3 million people die on the roads each year worldwide. You might think that who gets hit and who gets killed doesn't discriminate, but that's not true. 90% of those fatalities are in poor or middle-income countries, and car fatalities is the second leading cause of death worldwide among children aged 5 to 14. Our most vulnerable people in the most vulnerable people in the world are being slaughtered on the roads. Enter Google, Tesla, Volvo, and other companies and universities, all trying to implement autonomous cars, driverless car technology. These are cars that would not have any driver, but the computer would take over and drive for them. Experts estimate that 90% of these fatalities would be avoided if we implemented this technology. So arguably, you have an ethical imperative to implement it as quickly as possible. But as soon as you start to think about it, you realize that you're up to your neck in ethical issues. A pedestrian walks out in front of the road. What does the car do? You need to program that in. Does the car hit the pedestrian? Does the car do a kind of utilitarian calculus over how many people will, trying to minimize total life loss? Does the car take into account how old and young they are? Does the car risk the passenger himself or herself? You might think, well, when I'm driving, I don't make all these big ethical decisions all the time. That's not true. Anytime you shift risk from one person to another, you're making an ethical decision. These instructions need to be programmed into these cars. As the cars are going around, they're sensing everything, and all of these choices have to be made. You're not going to, at the end of the day, imagine putting next to the lights a dial, from good to evil. Incidentally, in studies, people want other cars to be dialed to good and not their car. Okay, socially responsible science. Now let me talk about UCSD for a little bit. UC San Diego is no stranger to socially responsible science. In fact, it's in our DNA. This is Founders Day, Founders Weekend, and our main founder, Roger Revelle, not only did he discover climate change, but he also tried to do something about it. He went to D.C. and then he came back, and when he came back, he was a professor of science, technology, and public affairs, working on many of the same topics that Jennifer does. Our first chancellor, Herb York, whom I had the pleasure to meet, worked on coming up with an atomic bomb in the Manhattan Project, probably the most ethically fraught research ever. And then he spent the rest of his life working on nuclear deterrence. And it's not just founding scientists either. My former colleague in history, Naomi Oreskes, used her historical talents to unearth much that's interesting about the climate change debate, and she's become a leading voice in the country on that topic. And there's no shortage of these things, so if we look at faculty around us now, here's Larry Goldstein, one of the leading stem cell researchers in the world. He's wondering whether it's okay for him to inject stem cells into various people, and like with the Cars case, he's got the pressure of knowing that he's got this science that can potentially help innumerable people. And here's Ethan Baer, one of the top geneticists in the world. Using the new CRISPR technique, He could transform the genome of a mosquito so that it can't transmit malaria, a killer of 600,000 people per year, and he's wondering whether the goods obtained by doing that outweigh the environmental risks. But we don't just have ethical problems, we have problem solvers as well. The campus is just stuffed with people in the social sciences and all and humanities, and just focusing on my own department because I know it. So the top two, Dana Nelkin and David Brink, they've been working lately on psychopathology and criminal responsibility. When do brain defects function as excuses? It's a big issue for the law. Dana's here, so you could talk to her later if you like. My colleague Nancy Cartwright works on philosophy of science and social and public policy, especially on education lately. She was recently honored as one of the 19 most influential scholars of the 20th century. My new colleague, Kerry McKenzie, who's also here, she's working on the cost, the huge cost that pseudoscience imposes upon society. So anyway, my vision is just to take all these smart people, put them together into an Institute of Practical Ethics. It doesn't have to have the pool. In my experience, it's just that simple. If you put a bunch of smart people like that together, you know, great research will happen. Now the pool thing got me thinking. You put great people like that together, and the thing is, they will be really unique. So here you'd have, what I'm imagining is something where you have these cutting-edge natural scientists working alongside ethicists and great social scientists. What would you get from such a thing? Well, I think you get a lot. So first of all, you get good science. So the idea of all of this is not to slow science, but just the opposite. Figure out what's responsible, and then full steam ahead. You also get good guidance on policy and law. Think about all the different issues of the day, the things like this, the driverless cars and all of that. You hear statements from the Hastings Center. You hear statements from the Kennedy Institute of Ethics. You barely hear a peep from the West Coast. I think with a prominent center, we could leverage our unique history, all right, and our current expertise to become a leading voice in this country on national policy when it comes to socially responsible science. And finally, last but not least, the chancellor has asked, you know, in his strategic plan for us to become a student-centered institution. We could teach the scientists and others of tomorrow, equip them so that they can better handle the ethical dilemmas that they're going to face. So what we've done so far we just started off small, but there are a few little accomplishments we can mention. So first, I'm very proud of the fact that my department will, in January, open its doors to the first bioethics minors. It's a small step, but I think it's important that, you know, we have hundreds of students going off into the health profession. I think it's great that they're going to get training there. I hope to unroll a master's program in bioethics joint with the med school, and that will train doctors and others. Tomorrow morning, I talk to a company about developing bioethics training software. With Larry Goldstein, the stem cell person, we're looking to search and hire some of the top bioethicists in the world and bring them here. With Ethan Baer and the Craig Venter Institute, we're going to have a workshop in a couple of months devoted to the environmental risks of genetic engineering. So you can see, and even in just these little small cases, how research, teaching, and industry all feed off one another. So far, all of this is just piecemeal. But what I can imagine is, with the help of people on and off campus, developing something much greater, something that really realizes the vision of our founders of having a unique public institution. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.